of the uranium from Canada. That's the Gore, Oklahoma, Kerr-McGee plant. And the waste from there, that's it's another horror story. It's raffinite, about 17 toxic metals, and the whole radium chain. They were doing deep well injection within about 10 feet of the water table, and the people got an injunction to stop them. So they stayed quiet for a little while, and then they declared that their raffinite was really a fertilizer. They've just asked to expand their waste dumping on the land to about 7,000 to 8,000 acres of prime farm and pasture land in eastern Oklahoma. Again, it's a Cherokee reserve.
What's a jellyfish baby?
Well, that's a term given by the Marshallese to the hydatidiform mole. That's the medical term. It's a blighted pregnancy. It's probably a cross between a birth defect and a cancer. It's a pretty horrible experience for a woman who thinks she's pregnant and carries this tumor in place of a baby, and then gives birth to the tumor. So this was a shocking experience for the Marshallese after the weapon testing. They had no history of this in the Marshall Islands. I talked to one woman and she said she held her baby until it died and then she buried it so her husband wouldn't see it. The hydatidiform mole has a second form which has like a stalk, which is the umbilical cord, and then a lot of small tumors or cysts on that stalk, and the women call that giving birth to a bunch of grapes. The British did their testing in Montebello Island, and the fallout went right across the center of Australia. The central part of Australia is where the Aboriginal people live. Then in Maralinga, southern Australia, they had more tests, and they put up signs for people to stay off of the testing ground, but the signs were always in English, and most of the indigenous people don't speak English and they don't read the signs. I know one of the Maralinga tests, they actually discovered a family of Aboriginal people who had made a home in the crater after the test, and they were found dead.
Rosalie Bertel was a Canadian-American anti-nuclear activist and the founder of the International Institute of Concern for Public Health, also a sister of the Grey Nuns of the Sacred Heart. Her book, No Immediate Danger, Prognosis for a Radioactive Earth, was published in 1985. In 1986, Bertel received the Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel Prize. Rosalie Bertel passed away in 2012. Thanks to Terry Roach and Robert Fripp for their song Exposure. Read more about Rosalie Bertel and the other voices in this voicescape at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, click on that subscription box and pull out your credit card. You'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. Of the Second World War in response to Nazi and Japanese war crimes, not American ones, four treaties were drafted, updating the laws of war. The four Geneva Conventions came into force in 1949 and would be ratified by 196 nations, some of them with reservations. 30 years later, in response to changes in how wars were being fought, two additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions were drafted. Article 36 of the first protocol dealt with new weapons and methods of warfare. in the study, development, acquisition, or adoption of a new weapon, means, or method of warfare, Article 36 reads, a high contracting party is under an obligation to determine whether its employment would, in some or all circumstances, be prohibited by this protocol or by any other rule of international law. Today, Article 36 is cited as the basis for banning weapons that kill autonomously, killer robots, in popular lingo. Robotic dogs are now on the market. The New York Police Department uses them. They've not been equipped to kill yet. Then, there are drones that swarm, drop tear gas, and shoot, and automated gun sentries that read faces, then kill. Now, a UK-based NGO is calling for legal standards, Article 36, they call themselves. I reached Elizabeth Miner in London. Now, an autonomous weapon system, that's pretty straightforward. It's a weapon system that's autonomous, that operates independently from human control. It just does what it does. But when we talk about killer robots, of course, that's the popular term, which is very graphic. One imagines humanoids, things walking around with laser fingers, and these robotic dogs come to my mind, which are terrifying. I've seen videos of them, and they look like dogs, and they walk, and they can be armed. I guess that's a killer robot. What do we mean by autonomous weapon systems and killer robots?
I suppose what we would define as autonomous weapon systems, which is also kind of a definition that, say, the International Committee of the Red Cross uses, is weapon systems that basically, once they've been kind of activated or put in place or, you know, turned on by a human being, there's a period of space and time where they operate sort of automatically, right? So they use sensors to collect data from the environment. They then calculate whether the information sensed matches a kind of target profile of what they're supposed to be hitting. And if that matches up, then they will apply force automatically. So this is, you know, without a human making a specific decision about where and when and what exactly is hit by this weapon system. A lot of systems with that process of functioning kind of already exist in military technologies, right? So for example, if you think about missile defense systems that are used by navies in boats, these are, you know, high-speed systems that are turned on for a few seconds to scan a particular area of sky. And if they sense an object of a certain size traveling at a certain speed, then they will fire against it to, you know, destroy that missile. So, you know, technologies like that have been around for a while. Obviously, they're sort of not without their challenges and problems because of this, you know, automatic functioning of force. And sometimes they, you know, go wrong and hit the wrong thing, for example. There's examples of missile defense systems hitting civilian aircraft and other instances where it's, well, either malfunctioned or hasn't been in, you know, 100% kind of human control in a way. What we're concerned with, I suppose, is, you know, a trend for greater automation and the integration of more complex technologies into these kind of weapon systems with that process of functioning, where there's like sensors that then calculate and apply force to objects or people automatically. So when we talk about killer robots, I suppose we're talking about a direction of travel towards weapon systems that are more and more outside of human control in a way, right? Where the distance between a weapon system applying force to a person or a thing is getting further and further from a human making a decision about how that system should be used, what should be happening, getting closer to, I suppose, delegating to machines the decision to take a human life, right? So we're particularly concerned with autonomous weapon systems that target people, that sense people as objects and would apply force automatically to people. We're not so concerned, I suppose, about, you know, the Terminator, though he gets a lot of media coverage, because the sort of weapon systems that are in development are more, I suppose, evolutions on what we already have and what we're seeing at the moment. So, you know, kind of drone technologies being increasingly autonomous, and things like, for example, there's sentry gun technologies, which have been around for a while.
Sentry gun technology.
Yeah. So say, for example, there's a system that exists on the border between North and South Korea, which can automatically sense a person in a kind of a heat shape, right, is how this operates. And then in the mode in which it's used by users at the moment would alert the person using this system to a person has been sensed in this place where they shouldn't be, and the person operating the system takes a decision on whether to, you know, fire on that person, right? But it can operate also in an automatic mode, right? So technologies exist whereby people can be sensed by machines and force can be applied automatically to them by weapon systems.
Okay, so one can imagine these kinds of systems which are static that just sit in place, like an air defense system, for example, that automatically fires at something coming towards it, or a sentry device at the border which senses somebody moving and either operates autonomously or not. But how about things that one would actually refer to as robots, like these robotic dogs that I've seen that are very scary? I mean, are these things real? Are people developing, are armed forces developing these kinds of mobile robotic devices that could fire at a person, a protester, or somebody?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of militaries at the moment are heavily investing in robotics and autonomy and AI in various ways, right? So, I mean, say with the robotic dogs that you mentioned, I think that, you know, their kind of first purpose or application is meant to be sort of in logistics and stuff like that, right? Rather than that they would be sent out to, you know, and be weaponized and used kind of like as a little soldier trotting along the ground.
So they carry things.
Yeah, like they carry things. Though, I mean, they can carry a gun, right? And there are videos on the internet of, well, people claiming that they've, you know, put weapons on these kind of robots and then, yeah, remote controlled them, you know, and used them in different kind of scenarios. I think not in, you know, combat at the moment, but just kind of as a, you know, as a demonstrator. So, yeah, there's a lot of potential for different things. I think that, yeah.
And then there are drones, of course. I mean, there are these robotic dogs that are totally bizarre to look at and really creepy. But then you've got aerial vehicles, armed aerial vehicles, drones, quadcopters, these small things that armed forces have that can drop tear gas or bombs on command.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that like the direction in terms of developments in military technology and what militaries are maybe more interested in is, yeah, more in this area of, say, drones, like increasing automation in drones, in the flying of drones and stuff like that, automatic sensing of targets or the, you know, processing of information to suggest targets and this kind of things. One example of, I suppose, the direction of travel towards greater autonomy in weapon systems, which is a concern to us, is in a class of weapons called loitering munitions, which are also known as like suicide drones. So basically, these are small, you know, aerial systems which can be sent out over an area for a period of time to loiter before, you know, to identify the targets that they're looking for. And when they sense the target that they're, you know, kind of programmed to find, they, you know, basically dive bomb and explode into that to apply force to it.
Are these things in operation?
Yeah, so quite a few countries kind of have these or are developing them at the moment. For example, you know, I think Turkey and Israel, companies there have systems. The US is developing these as well. You've seen them in use in recent conflicts. So, for example, in Nagorno-Karabakh, in a conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, you saw loitering munitions used. You see a lot of use in the conflict, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and also in Libya, for example, in recent years. I'm not saying that, you know, these are things that would necessarily, at the moment, you know, violate the standards that we want to see established by the international community, but they're definitely kind of, you know, going towards that direction of, you know, less human control and more, you know, kind of more functions being given to a machine. So just to give you a couple of examples there, I guess, there is a system called the CARGU, a loitering munition, which was a UN panel reported on its use in Libya a couple of years ago. So it was used by a party to the conflict in Libya a couple of years ago and reported on by a UN panel of experts who were looking at the situation in Libya. And so the manufacturer says with this weapon system that it has automatic target recognition capabilities and that these can be extended, or it's looking to extend these to facial recognition. We don't know whether that's been used yet in a kind of autonomous mode, but you know, that's concerning from our perspective in terms of these, you know, dynamics of targeting people, dehumanization, and sort of, you know, distancing the use of force from human decision making increasingly, right?
Elizabeth Miner, why would anybody want to develop a completely autonomous weapon system? You'd think that military people would want to be able to control the use of their weapons. Why would any country want to develop a weapon system that they could just send out there and it would be totally free to kill people?
Well, yes, indeed. And I think that, you know, a lot of the concern and skepticism about increasing autonomy in weapon systems, some of that comes from military people, right? Raising exactly the question you say, you know, they don't want to use technologies that are out of their control, because they want to control the effects of what they're doing. And, you know, people want to uphold the law, which, you know, involves not using weapons that are out of control and discriminate and stuff like that. I mean, I think from our point of view, the law is still very much addressed to human beings, and responsibility and accountability needs to rest with human beings, right? So if you have technologies which become more and more complex, harder to understand, and are operating for a longer period without a human decision making, that's very legally problematic, apart from anything else. But yes, why do we need a campaign to stop killer robots? You would have thought it would be a bit of a no-brainer, right?
But I mean, I guess the question is, who out there, aside from the most reprehensible regimes, I'm not sure who I'd name as the most put on the top of the list of reprehensible regimes, but who out there is actually developing, perhaps at the prototype stage, fully autonomous weapon systems? And why would they do that? Yeah. Or is it simply a matter of, really, is the greatest concern simply the matter that you've alluded to, that these systems get more and more complex and are run by artificial intelligence systems that can themselves go rogue or go awry, like the autonomous vehicle that's driving the car and you're sleeping behind the wheel, and suddenly your Tesla automobile, self-driving automobile, makes the wrong decision autonomously and kill somebody, for example. So they just go wrong. It's not like it was developed to run autonomously.
I suppose what you see in the picture of kind of states developing technologies, being interested in AI and autonomy and stuff like that, is various countries are considering this is the next revolution in warfare, which they need to be pursuing in order to keep their strategic edge over geopolitical rivals. For example, in the US, there's a very, you know, concerted push to be looking at AI and autonomy and these kinds of technologies in general, in order to keep the edge over, say, China in particular. China itself is also developing weapon systems and the use of AI in military applications and stuff like that. But, you know, seeing this in various other countries as well, the UK is itself very interested in integrating AI into defense and autonomy. Israel as well, I mentioned, has a lot of technology companies working in this area. I mentioned Turkey, Russia, and a lot of the kind of, you know, so-called major military powers or, you know, advanced militaries in the world are looking at kind of these developments in the area of, pushing autonomy and AI into weapon systems.
And making these systems completely autonomous.
Well, I suppose this is the thing, right? Because a lot of countries would say, you know, they're not pursuing fully autonomous weapons systems, right? The UK government says this, for example. They don't want to see things that are like, you know, entirely out of human control. What they're doing is just, you know, trying to, well, you know, do force multiplication or just, you know, get the edge with systems that can operate faster, or, you know, swarming drone technologies or things like that, which they think will, you know, increase the military edge. But they're not saying that, you know, they want things which in their view would be kind of fully autonomous in that they weren't under proper human control. And I guess this is where the kind of, you know, the debate lines are in terms of talking about international regulation and how we tackle these weapon systems. Because, yeah, you know, no one's making the argument for weapon systems that are like totally out of human control. But what that means is, you know, different to different people, right?
Swarming drone technology. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so this is something else that is in development, of having basically a load of, you know, really tiny little drones, which are kind of, you know, operating together in a swarm, like based on nature, right? So a lot of these things are based on research of nature. So they kind of flock together using AI and autonomous technologies to like fly in a certain way together. And a lot of countries are also looking into these kinds of developments and what their military applications could be, and whether, you know, you would weaponize small drones like that and use them for the application of force, or whether you'd use them for other kind of applications.
Where does treaty development stand at the moment? Where do the efforts of Article 36 and its allies stand in bringing about drafting and bringing into force new and stronger treaties, or strengthening existing treaties?
Yeah, so, I mean, at the international level, countries are currently discussing the issue of autonomous weapon systems under the framework of a treaty that's called the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapon Systems. Basically, this is a treaty which has 120-odd states parties. It has yearly meetings at the UN offices in Geneva, and its purpose as a convention is basically to, well, put prohibitions or restrictions on weapons technologies which are of, well, particular concern to the international community in the conventional space. So because they cause superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering, which is a kind of category of illegal weapons in international law, or because they're indiscriminate by their nature, or because, you know, for other reasons, countries are concerned about them and want, you know, prohibitions or regulations. So this convention, for example, prohibits blinding laser weapons. It has a protocol regulating the use of anti-personnel landmines, which actually a lot of the international community decided was insufficient, and negotiated a separate treaty to completely prohibit those technologies. It can look at new weapons technologies and decide what action to take on them. So there's been discussions there about lethal autonomous weapon systems, as they've termed them in this space, for, you know, about the past 10 years. We've seen in that time, you know, a kind of, well, some positive developments, right, in terms of a greater understanding amongst states of, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about autonomous weapon systems, what are the concerns, and what might be the kind of, you know, the policy response we need to see, which I think there's convergence around the idea that we need to completely prohibit certain systems and applications, and then regulate the use of a range of other weapons technologies and sensor-based weapon systems to make sure we maintain this meaningful human control over the use of force. But unfortunately, this convention, it operates by a consensus rule, right? So no decisions can go forward without the agreement of all states. And various countries mobilize this rule to mean, you know, total unanimity, and any disagreement with their, you know, basically that they can use this as a veto. So various countries who are party to the convention, it includes a lot of, you know, militarized states, you know, aren't keen on moving forward for a new international legal instrument to prohibit and regulate autonomous weapon systems. That's not something they want to see. Russia in particular, in this forum, is playing the role at the moment of vetoing any progress. Some other states say they don't want to see any kind of international law or even political standards at all. And others, such as, you know, the UK, the US, Australia, a few others in this group, are saying, you know, it would be best to approach this from a point of view of doing, you know, best practices and guidelines and political standards to guide the use of autonomous weapon systems, which we obviously think is insufficient for this, you know, very serious problem, which is a huge, you know, challenge to the structure of the law as it is at the moment, and to, you know, various ethical principles, right? But on the, I suppose, you know, positive side, we're seeing a kind of increased enthusiasm amongst a larger group of states, like for a new treaty on autonomous weapon systems, right? So I think now over 90 countries have said in that forum, the Convention on Conventional Weapons, that, you know, they want to see a new legally binding instrument on autonomous weapon systems. We've had, for example, this year, earlier in the year, in Costa Rica, the Foreign Ministry of Costa Rica convened a regional conference for Latin American and Caribbean states, who issued a political declaration, you know, committing to negotiate a new international legal instrument on autonomous weapon systems, because, you know, this is a kind of urgent issue. And we've also seen, you know, communiques from, I think there was a set of presidents from Ibero-America, so including, like, you know, Spain and Portugal in Europe, but also Latin American countries, calling for negotiations on a legally binding instrument. We had a call from the Secretary General of the United Nations recently, you know, imploring states to negotiate a treaty on this issue area by 2026 to, you know, well, I suppose get ahead of the developments that are happening at the moment. And I think we'll see in the coming kind of, you know, months and year, more of this kind of commitment from different regions of the world, like basically putting pressure on for the negotiation of a treaty.
Elizabeth Miner, last question. What role can software engineers and weapon systems engineers, all those high-minded people with a powerful sense of ethics, what role can they play? Should they play? What role are they playing? The community, international community of software engineers and systems designers.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very important question, right? And also, a lot of the, you know, concern that we've seen at autonomous weapon systems and these technologies has come from the tech sector, right? Of people who don't want their work to be used, you know, for these applications and in this way. And some of the people in the campaign to stop killer robots are, you know, software engineers who, say, quit their jobs at Google when Google was working on these projects with the military to do with, you know, identifying, software to look at kind of identifying targets and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, it's very important for these people and sectors to kind of raise their voice and join calls for, you know, for a new treaty on autonomous weapons, but more broadly for, like, take their work and their technology not to be used in this way, whether it's working within their own institutions or as part of kind of broader groupings. But it would also be easier for software engineers to be able to do this if there was strong international law saying, you know, these particular applications are banned and this kind of thing.
Elizabeth Miner is an advisor for Article 36, a UK-based group that wants autonomous weapon systems to be tightly regulated or banned. Read more about Article 36's work and killer robots at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. And by the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.